Hi, writers. Here we are with a new episode on the art and craft of writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer. How good can good writing be? In his new memoir titled Everywhere and Oink Oink, the playwright and screenwriter and director, David Mamet, says, "I'll read the instructions for a hammer if well written." That'd be good writing, wouldn't it? Instructions for a hammer. And I sure wish I had the courage to title a book Everywhere and Oink Oink. My favorite book title is Gone with the Wind, but Everywhere and Oink Oink comes close. I've mentioned in earlier episodes that I believe our writing should be a clear window to the story, that the reader should see the story, not the words on the page. That's true of most novels I read and most novels published and sold. Many great writers subscribe to this clear window technique. But once in a while, I come across a novel where the writing is intentionally beautiful, where the writer has polished her sentences and has sharpened her observations. And the writer, I think, means for the reader to enjoy the words and phrases and the sentences in addition to the story. I've not tried this to be overly beautiful in my sentence-by-sentence writing because I don't know if I'm up to the task, and in any event, I'm comfortable with the clear window theory. The best way to learn to write is to read writers we like and ask, what are they doing that is so good? What is it that is capturing us in the prose? If we want to be a writer who polishes his words, to offer more than a clear window, to create something beautiful in sentences, here are some novels from famous writers who can be examples for us. I've read these novels and marveled at the writing. Here are several. Showboat by Edna Ferber, or another of her novels, So Big, or another, The Song of the Lark. I get the impression from her novels that Edna Ferber was a wonderful person. I wish I'd have known her. Or try this, East of Eden by John Steinbeck. Or Beloved by Toni Morrison. The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers. And last on my list, My Antonia by Willa Cather. These novels are worth reading just for the sentences. I like the stories too, but the writing was so crafted that the words weren't a clear picture because they kept bringing me out of the story to think about the writing. In some novels, that's a good thing if the writer has the skill. It's a rare skill, though. I'm still a believer in the glass window theory. Our words should be invisible on the page, so the reader can become fully engaged with the story. But if you've got the skill of these sentence-by-sentence writers, consider using it. I'm reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Benjamin Franklin, one of America's founding fathers. At 16 years old, Franklin wrote a weekly column for a Boston newspaper using the immortal pseudonym Silence Do Good. Walter Isaacson, the biographer, said that Franklin as an adult was probably America's best writer. And here's something about another of our legendary writers, the master of science fiction, Ray Bradbury. The Wall Street Journal reviewed a new book, Remembrance, Selected Correspondence of Ray Bradbury. The article in the Wall Street Journal is written by John J. Miller, and Miller points out, and this is John Miller, the first sentence of Fahrenheit 451 is one of literature's great opening lines. It was a pleasure to burn. Regarding when Ray Bradbury was a young man, an unknown writer back in 1943, Bradbury wrote, "My average is one sale out of every three stories." Bradbury later estimated having received more than 2,000 rejections. John J. Miller continues in the Wall Street Journal, "Much of Remembrance reveals the grind of authorship. Bradbury aimed, quote, to turn out at least 1,000 words a day," Bradbury wrote in 1941. John J. Miller says, "His most frequent correspondence in this volume is Don Congdon, his longtime agent, a reminder that, for all of Bradbury's artistry, he was a commercial writer in search of his next sale or blurb for his next book." And John J. Miller writes, "The letters brim with writing advice. Bradbury recommends reducing stories down to a sharp, cutting, wonderful edge." This honing, Bradbury argued, is one of the great arts of writing. Ray Bradbury told Stephen King about Bradbury's 1962 novel, Something Wicked This Way Comes. Bradbury said, "I love the book best of all the things I've ever written." And listen to this. It's nice to know this about one of our great writers. John J. Miller in the Wall Street Journal writes about Bradbury. "Bradbury was a happy man who loved his wife, took joy in his four daughters, and felt grateful for his success." Bradbury said, "I am one of God's lucky children." He reflected on his good fortune to Russell Kirk in 1967. This is Bradbury. "The thing that drives me most often is an immense gratitude that I was given this one chance to live, to be alive, the one time round in a miraculous experience that never ceases to be glorious and dismaying." Aren't those wonderful sentences from Ray Bradbury in John J. Miller's review of Remembrance? You've heard me say that plots and plot points don't come easily or quickly to me. I have to work at them. That's not the way with some writers. John D. MacDonald, author of the wonderful Travis McGee detective novels, once said that a novelist has far more ideas, which he called the fun part, than the time to write them. I came across an interesting article titled "Pump Up Your Creativity," written by the novelist Stephen James. He asks in the article, "What do you do when you slide behind the computer, slip your fingers onto the keyboard, and nothing happens? You sweat and squirm, pound on the desk and curse at the cursor, but it doesn't do any good. Your story has stalled out. How do you jumpstart your brain?" That's Stephen James, and it's a good question. He offers some things we might do to spark our creativity. Here are some of his thoughts, and this is Stephen James. Explore your life, and he writes with full caps, L-I-F-E. "Life is a limitless well of ideas waiting to be tapped." And Stephen James says, "Life stands for literature, imagination, folklore, and experience." And James writes, "Coax new stories from classic plots by setting them in a different time and place. Examine your imagination for themes that pique our interest. Search through the timeless motifs of myth, fairy tale, and folklore. Scour the expanse of our own experiences to spark new ideas. Let your memories come alive." That's Stephen James. And then his second idea to pump up our creativity is to change our perspective. And he writes, "Look at our story from another person's perspective. Step into the shoes of our main character and write a journal entry, a complaint letter, or a love letter. Switch our point of view. Write a few paragraphs in first or third person. Think of how you would respond if you were in the story." And then Stephen James's third technique for increasing our creativity is let serendipity happen. And according to the dictionary, serendipity is the faculty of finding valuable or agreeable things not sought after. Stephen James writes, If you're drained of ideas, you might be trying too hard. You can't make happy chance discoveries until you step away and stop worrying. Relax. Worrying about problems is like looking at bacteria through a microscope. It doesn't help them go away. It only makes them look bigger. So work smarter, not harder. Break your routine. Go to a movie. Have a cup of coffee. Abstain from octopus. Try writing in a different place or at a different time. Lift weights. Get up in the middle of the night. Place yourself in situations where you are not at ease. Risking and responding to new challenges forces you to think creatively and opens the door for serendipity. Stephen James's next technique is to set boundaries. And he notes that photographers focus on a single event and snap the picture. And James writes, "Nothing stalls writing more effectively than lack of focus. Freedom to write anything usually ends up as an excuse for not writing anything. What's your story really about? What's the theme, the deadline, the word count? If you weren't assigned any boundaries, set them yourself." Stephen James's next technique for pumping up our creativity is to look for connections. And he writes, "Creativity occurs at the intersection of ideas, when two thoughts that seem to have nothing in common collide and form something new. Don't feel pressured to develop ideas from scratch. Look for ways of combining two or more familiar things into something novel and technique. Do this by forcing yourself to make connections. Look for parallels or connections between things that seem to have nothing in common. Let unexpected connections spark your writing." And then Stephen James's sixth technique is ask stupid questions. Don't be afraid to ask obvious, even stupid questions. And he writes, "Describe the finished story to someone. What has to happen before you get there? What does the reader need to know by the end? You may have left out a key thought, clue, or concept. Ask, what's missing from my story? What have I left out? What would naturally come next?" Use what-if questions to jar you toward a unique solution. And then his last technique is question your direction. And Stephen James writes, "Sometimes we write ourselves into a corner. We try harder and harder to scale the walls we've erected without ever wondering, does this story even need that corner? Question where you're going. Don't assume that you're headed in the right direction just because you're picking up from where you left off yesterday." These techniques for increasing our creativity, to pump up our creativity, are from the novelist Stephen James. If we're stuck in our plotting, we can consider these to help us get going. I received a question from our listener, Sean, and he writes, "I'm having a hard time describing my protagonist. The story is in third person from his point of view. He lives in an area without still water and a time without mirrors. Any suggestion for how to do this while remaining in his head?" That's a good question. Here's what I do to describe a character. I just stop the story and describe him or her with two or three sentences. Most of the time, a prop, such as having him stand in front of a mirror, or a segue, such as having him wonder if he looks older now and then describing himself, aren't needed. Here's an example of a prop used to set up a character description. This is me writing. Allison stepped outside the fitting room wearing the jeans and stared at the mirror. The jeans were too loose around her hips. She brushed aside hair from her forehead. She leaned toward the mirror to study herself. Her hair was lighter than in the winter, less dishwasher, more blonde. Her eyebrows rose when she spotted new, faint wrinkles at the corners of her eyes. And so on. The mirror is a prop, and it impresses me as gimmicky to have our characters stand in front of a mirror. And here's an example of a segue. It's not too bad. Marlene wondered how she was aging. She pulled a lock of her hair from above an ear and looked at it, more silver than gray. Her hand had new spots on it and now looked like her mother's had late in her life. Marlene's nose was her best feature, as it was straight and slender. Hear the segue? Marlene wondered. It's fine. It sets up the description that is coming. But we don't need a gimmick, such as a mirror or a segue. Rather, we can just stop to describe the character. Right in the middle of the story, here's an example, something like this. Jones gripped the pommel, put his foot into the stirrup, and climbed onto the horse. His hands were calloused from handling ropes, and his legs had become a touch bowed from riding these years. He had a quick smile with good teeth and a notch in his chin that made him appear playful. The lobe on his left ear was missing due to an accident with a bottle when he was a kid. Here, I've just planted the description of Jones in the story. The story's action after the description can keep going. He spurs his horse forward. And then maybe a page or two later, there might be another couple of sentences of description, this time perhaps his clothing. And here's an example regarding his clothing. And notice that there's no gimmick or transition phrase or sentence before or after the description. I just put the description in there. Jones led the Palomino into the barn toward its stall. His jeans were frayed at the hems, and his vest's wool lining had almost entirely worn away. His boots were low in the heels. The description is just there about Jones's clothing. I didn't need to use a gimmick or a segue. That's what I do. I just stop the story and add sentences of description. It works most of the time. We can just put the description in there. And here's more regarding character description. This is some examples from Edna Ferber's wonderful novel, A Song of the Lark. I think the best way to get better at writing is to read good writers, or in this case of the podcast here, listen to good writers. Here's Edna Ferber. He was a gleaming, florid young fellow. His hair, thick and yellow, was cut very short, and he wore a closely trimmed beard, long enough on the chin to curl a little. Even his eyebrows were thick and yellow, like fleece. He had lively blue eyes. Thea looked up at them with great interest as he sat chatting and swinging his foot rhythmically. Here's another description from Edna Ferber. Dr. Archie was barely 30. He was tall, with massive shoulders, which he held stiffly, and a large, well-shaped head. He was a distinguished-looking man for that part of the world. There was something individual in the way in which his reddish-brown hair, parted cleanly at the side, brushed over his high forehead. His nose was straight and thick, and his eyes were intelligent. He wore a curly, reddish mustache and an imperial, but trimly, which made him look a little like the pictures of Napoleon III. His hands were large and well-kept, but ruggedly formed, and the backs were shaded with crinkly reddish hair. He wore a blue suit of woolly, wide-wailed serge. The traveling men had known at a glance that it was made by a Denver tailor. The doctor was always well-dressed. Here's another example of a skilled description from that same novel by Edna Ferber. His visitor was a tall, loosely built man with a thin brown beard streaked with gray. He wore a frock coat, a broad-brimmed black hat, a white lawn necktie, and steel-rimmed spectacles. Altogether, there was a pretentious and important air about him as he lifted the skirts of his coat and sat down. These are sharp, memorable descriptions by a skilled writer. I'm learning something as I read these, and that something is how to describe a character the reader won't forget. Here's another, couple more. She was a short, stalwart woman, with a short neck and a determined-looking head. Her skin was very fair, her face calm and unwrinkled, and her yellow hair, braided down her back as she lay in bed, still looked like a girl's. Here's another description from Edna Ferber. Wunsch wore a collar button but no collar. His hair was cropped close. He was short and stocky, with something rough and bear-like about his shoulders. His face was a dark, bricky red, deeply creased rather than wrinkled, and the skin was like loose leaves over his neck. He wore a brass collar button. His hair was cropped close, iron-gray bristles on a bullet-like head. His eyes were always suffused and bloodshot. He had a coarse, scornful mouth and irregular yellow teeth, much worn at the edges. His hands were square and red, seldom clean, but always alive, impatient, even sympathetic. And here is Edna Ferber again. Listen to how she does it. Thea's rival was also a blonde, but her hair was much heavier than Thea's and fell in long, round curls over her shoulders. She was the angel child of the Baptists and looked exactly like the beautiful children on soap calendars, with her pink and white face. Her set smile of innocence were surely born of a color press. She had long, drooping eyelashes, a little pursed-up mouth, and narrow, pointed teeth like a squirrel's. Here's one more. This is Edna Ferber. Ray looked his best out of doors when his thick red hands were covered by gloves and the dull red of his sunburned face somehow seemed right in the light and wind. He looked better, too, with his hat on. His hair was thin and dry, with no particular color or character. Regular Willy Boy character, as he himself described it. His eyes were pale beside the reddish bronze of his skin. They had the faded look often seen in the eyes of men who have lived much in the sun and wind and who have been accustomed to train their vision upon distant objects. Isn't that lovely? Boy, that sure gives us a good impression of Ray, an important character in Song of the Lark. I'd like to do one more. These are so good by Edna Ferber. Old Mrs. Lorch was fat and jolly, with a red face always shining as if she had just come from the stove, bright little eyes and hair of several colors. Her own hair was one of cast iron gray, her switch another and her false front still another. Her clothes always smelled of savory cooking, except when she was dressed for church or coffee klatch, and then she smelled of bay rum or of the lemon verbena sprig which she tucked inside her puffy black kid gloves. Those are descriptions from Edna Ferber. Boy, she's a real lesson on how to describe a character. Oh, my cat Jack has trained me well. He spends a lot of time on my desk, and when he wants down, when he wants off the desk, he no longer jumps down as any self-respecting cat would, but rather he goes to the edge of the desk, and he hunches as if he's about ready to jump to the floor, and then he looks at me. And he'll look at me for 10 or 15 seconds and until I realize what's going on, and then I lift him from the desk and place him on the floor. Holy cow, my life has come to this. I've mentioned the advantages of contrast in our plotting in these podcast episodes. Want some contrast? Isaac Newton invented calculus, and I'm lifting a cat to the floor 6 or 8 times a day. We've wandered around and gone left and right and up and down, and now we've come to the end of this episode. Roy Rogers said, happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. This is Jim Thayer. Please keep smiling and keep tapping those keys.